And welcome back to The Edge, the weekly art show on all things art in Dubai and the region.
Tim Giel, are you on the line? Can you hear us, Tim?
I can hear you perfectly.
Yes, well, thank you so much for giving up time on a Monday morning. I don't know if you're in London or you're certainly in England.
Yes, I'm in London and it's a rather grey day, so I think of you in the sun.
Yes, well, it's 42 here and I think,
well,
you know,
that's envy for that.
I think Livingstone would sort of commiserate with us when we're out in the heat of the day, but certainly we're not sinking thigh deep into elephant footprints. I was sort of talking about that in the first half hour. I absolutely loved your book, Explorers of the Nile, The Triumph and Tragedy of a Great Victorian Adventure. And I can remember in 1960, I was obviously a tiny little baby or, you know, a child at that stage. My father was given for Christmas a copy of The White Nile by Alan Moorhead. And I think this is the first time in more than 50 years that anyone has chosen to cast light and sort of retell this fascinating stories of one of the world's mightiest rivers. Can you tell us why you took on such this sort of huge sort of topic?
Well, I suppose when I wrote The Lives, I'm the biographer of both Livingstone and Stanley. It did occur to me that the picture which Moorhead gave of both Livingstone and Stanley was completely it wasn't the picture which the facts from their diaries and everything would lead one to write, really. I mean, he didn't have the information that I had, because I had access to all the private papers of both men. And I, for example, discovered that Livingstone, although he had a great sense of humour, he called himself a dreadful old fogey, and with a smile like a hippopotamus, because all his teeth were falling out because of his African diet of grains and everything, and obviously not too much hygienic dental care. But he was quite an unpleasant man in some ways, particularly to fellow white explorers, and his son changed his name and went to live in a foreign country, America, and his wife became an alcoholic and died. But Livingstone was wonderful in various other ways. But so the rather marvellous picture of him that Moorhead painted was not really true. Similarly, he paints a picture of Stanley as a bit of a sort of monster, really, very much at variance with the facts of this very insecure, illegitimate person who had been brought up in a workhouse and had so much to prove in his life. So I thought, well, look, if the Moorhead version is so inaccurate on these two, let's look at it as it affects the others. And that's really what I did. I did lots more research on Baker and on Speak and on all the other of these remarkable human beings.
Yes, I think John Speak, you've sort of redressed the wrongs, really. The fact that he was not recognised, and the way that Burton tried to, you know, when he tragically shot himself, that he tried to sort of, you know, or say that it was suicide. And again, that's really probably the first time that that's come to light, do you think, in a book of this sort of, you know?
Yes, I would say so. I think that Burton's biographers, two of the best of Burton's biographers are women, and I think that they fell in love with their subject. And I mean, he was a very charismatic and extraordinary individual. But the problem for a biographer is, as soon as they start to get suspicions that their subject is actually maybe not a very nice person, they very often tend to try to bury them. And so the awful way in which Burton lied about Speke and misrepresented him, simply because he was jealous of Speke for actually discovering Lake Victoria on his own without him, has really not received the kind of due that it should do. And the tragedy for Speke is that his parents didn't keep any letters that he wrote from India. He was an army officer in India till he was 27 years old. And during that period, you might have thought that his family might have kept at least one or two letters that he sent home. But they thought so little of this man, who turned out to be a very, very great explorer, that they didn't keep any. And this has meant that really there's only one biography of him, because his letters to his publisher and a few other letters are the only ones that survive. And I was pretty desperate, you know, when I was thinking, how on earth can I tell more than the one biography of Speke tells? And I suddenly thought, why don't I look at the manuscript, the handwritten manuscript for his most famous book, and see whether there are any changes, you know, whether a lot of bits were cut out. And to my absolute amazement, he used this manuscript as a kind of confessional, that he'd actually fallen in love with an African woman. I mean, really in love, romantically in love. And he'd given the royal family of Buganda intimate sexual advice. And this was a man who Burton said was completely sexless and not interested in that side of life. And of course, in the 1960s, 70s, and onwards, of course, people think of sexless people who have no interest in either sex, as being sort of very incomplete human beings, rather cold and unattractive. And this has been poor Speke's fate as a result of what Burton said. But all the time, in this manuscript to this book, was buried the true facts about Speke, which very luckily I decided to read this document and found them out.
And he actually said about the editing of his book that his book had been gelded, didn't he?
Because
it was so awesome.
But he was lucky it was gelded in a way. And because if it hadn't been, you know what the Victorians were like. I mean, if he'd admitted that he'd had an affair with an African woman and fallen in love with her in public, and he seemed, you know, maybe he would have done if his publisher hadn't insisted that he didn't let on. Mm. But he would have been in terrible trouble. You know, public opinion simply wouldn't have... I mean, for a start, he wasn't married to her. And then there was the whole issue of race at that date. It would have been a very, very brave person at that date who made a public admission of unmarried sex with an African woman, wouldn't it, really?
Yes, in that time.
At that time, it would have been a complete disaster. Mm. In fact, actually, Burton and a friend of his wrote a book in which they made various suggestions that there was something unhealthy about Speke. If he had an interest in sex, it was to do with measuring immensely fat women and things like this. You know, so poor Speke was represented as a kind of pervert.
Yes.
Whereas Burton was endlessly collecting sexual statistics about African men. You can imagine what he measured. All this was absolutely fine for Burton to do, but when poor old Speke measured an enormously fat woman's upper arm, he was represented as a terrible pervert.
Yes, I think the thing is that Burton had a very charismatic sort of character, mm. and he was, you know, he was a sort of I don't know, he's sort of like a Count of Monte Cristo type of character, where he just sort of does things and he's living a lot of the time, you know, falsehoods and fantasy, but mm-hmm. he carried it off with his sort of, whereas Speke was a much more, you know, when the African chief, when he admitted to the African chief, when Speke admitted that he'd fallen in love, the African chief just said, well, why haven't you just taken her? And he said, because he spoke about the cords of love, didn't he? And
he needed it to be, she needed to respond and to reciprocate of her own free will,
yes.
and not for financial or any other reasons.
Yes.
And when she, of course, as you say, offered herself to him, he was quite sure, and he was right. I mean, she even told him, she said, I've never been with a poor man. Mm-hmm. I've been a king's wife, and then I've worked for the Queen Mother, and you know, I want the reason I want to come back to you is so that I will die in the favours of a rich man, mm-hmm. and that polished poor Speke off. Awesome. It told him absolutely she didn't love him and was using him financially. So poor Speke. But what one needs to remember about these people is that Burton just didn't have it. What it took, the kind of almost masochistic element in one's character to be a great explorer. You know, one needs to remember how ill they were, that almost all of them came within an inch of death, and of course Livingstone died in Africa, but all the rest of them, I mean Stanley for example, experienced that pre-death feeling of the tunnel of light, which so many people who've been almost dead and then come back experience. And both the Bakers, you know, Florence and Samuel, were so incredibly ill. I mean, they couldn't move, literally, for weeks. They lay like logs. And where they'd been rolled onto the ground by their attendants, they just couldn't move an arm or help themselves in any way. So one can tell, I mean, the terrible... I mean, you knew that this would happen to you when you set out into Central Africa. Central Africa, there was nothing on the map. You just saw a gap there on the European maps. Of course, the Africans knew perfectly well what was in the middle, and a number of energetic Arab slave traders knew quite well too. But no Europeans knew. So these Europeans who were going to get so desperately ill from malaria, bilharzia, and massive illnesses, were taking a huge risk with their lives. But somehow, the most daring of them were willing to do that because they thought that actually to solve this mystery that had been there ever since the ancient Egyptians, you know, was going to be just such a wonderful event for them. They didn't even think of it as actually necessarily making them money. It was just hugely elevating.
Yes.
Like the most ultimate bungee jump, you know, it was just so thrilling.
But unlike a bungee jump, they suffered. And I think what I so enjoyed about your book, Tim, was the descriptions. You actually, at times I had to turn away. And just remind me of the bit about, I mean, Livingstone had terrible problems with his teeth because of the diet. And what did he do about that? Just tell our listeners.
Well, you know that, of course, you know, in the Victorian period, people used to tie a string to a door and slam the door, which was very effective. It pulled the tooth out. But he didn't have that kind of option. So he would tie a string to his tooth, and he would have a revolver, which is pretty heavy. And he would tie one end to the revolver and the other to the tooth, and then he would fling the revolver away. Or else he would tie the string with the revolver on it. He would actually tie the string to a tree, say, and then whack the string with the revolver, the end of the revolver, as a heavy object.
Yes.
So it was pretty nasty. And if you did get things like terrible ulcers eating into the bones of the bottom of your feet through your foot, you know, you really felt that you were probably going to die of it. In fact, Livingstone did recover, but he couldn't move for over 6 months, which is terrible. If you think of how depressing that must have been, every time he put his foot down on the ground, that it sort of oozed
yes.
with horrible stuff under his foot. But he was a doctor, and he tried every kind of local remedy, because people, you know, had these terrible tropical eating ulcers for clearly generations there, and he asked everybody what they did about it.